Hello and welcome to the Right Minds podcast. This is the second episode and it is Tuesday the 16th of April 2019. My name is Diwa de Boer and my co-host here is Jesse Anderson. In today's episode we will be discussing the latest news of the past week. Specifically, we would like to touch on the big story in both New Zealand and Australia around freedom of speech and Israel Folau's story, his firing from Australia rugby, the designation by from some circles of the Bible, or at least parts of the Bible, as hate speech, and the whole reaction around how that should be treated both in the public and private sphere. We will also be talking about the latest polls in New Zealand. There have been two polls released since the last episode. We'd also like to touch a little bit on Julian Assange's arrest and the whole WikiLeaks saga, and we will discuss the implications for leaking data and, of course, how appropriate it is for whistleblowers to expose illegal activities by the government. Finally, at the end, we will probably close with some comments around the Notre Dame fire that happened today. The details on that are a little bit scarce at the time of recording, but I believe there's enough for us to discuss. And we will close off with a relevant piece of music from that as well. But please stick around until the end to get the story on that.
Well, the thing that really annoys me about the Israel Folau story is that it's constant. He's constantly being branded like all of it. They're constantly being branded anti-homosexual comments or you know, anti-gay tweet or whatever. But I mean, his comment said, "Hell awaits, you know, drunks, homosexuals, adulterers, liars, fornicators, thieves, atheists." They're not branded as anti-atheist, even though I'm pretty sure there are more atheists than homosexuals. There's obviously more fornicators, liars, and thieves than homosexuals, more drunks than homosexuals. But it always has to be from the really quote-unquote sensitive topic of homosexuality. It's got to be anti-homosexual, because nobody cares if you're anti-drunk or if you're anti, people just think you're straight edge and kind of annoying if you're anti-drunk. But if you're anti-homosexual, then you are a hateful KKK racist bigot.
You missed one of the eight sins that he listed, which was idolaters. That's where you stopped.
And sorry, I'm guilty of idolatry. Yeah, guilty, is the thing.
And that's one of the most interesting aspects for me, because this is sports, and what's the number one thing about sports is idolatry, and yeah, that's something that Israel Folau himself.
How they sell their merch.
Yeah, so the entire sports industry is based on idolatry. I won't make any comments around Israel Folau's involvement in that. You know, he's not directly responsible for his fans, but it's good to see that he's pointing out that his fans should not be idolizing him or anyone else. I'm not sure if that was his intention to do so, but clearly that's something that's been skipped over.
Yeah, I think Israel should really be applauded for sticking to his guns, not backing down, not saying sorry, I didn't mean it, and not removing idolaters and not removing anything that might implicate him. I mean, he's obviously told lies before, but he didn't remove liars. You know, it's not some sort of self-aggrandizing holier than thou sort of thing. It was a simple warning. I've been through his Twitter feed and it's nearly 100% just the regular Christian quotes that I see on Facebook every single day. It's not like he was posting this and going, ha, this will really stir the pot or anything like this. This was just his everyday post, and somebody went on his feed, found something they didn't like, and went, oh, this will make a good story.
If you look through his, and this is on Instagram, if you look through his Instagram feed or his Twitter feed, it's all stuff. It's all Christian stuff. It's all from the Bible.
Mm-hmm. All these KJV quotes.
I'm glad that he's a KJV user.
Well, I saw one street interviewer going out and obviously interviewing the public, and one lady seemed to think she was making a really good point by saying, you know, you're a sports player, I want you to play sports, not have an opinion. And it's like, what, you don't think these people are actual people who actually have opinions that lie outside of their profession? I mean would you really hire a builder on his because of his religious beliefs? It really shouldn't come into it.
He didn't go out of his way to do this either, right? If he were in the line of his work to go out and disrupt his work by doing something religious, you might say, hey, you should be focused on your work. This is his private Twitter feed, his private Instagram feed.
Imagine if he, for instance, took a knee while the national anthem was playing. I mean,
now we're getting controversial. Exactly, right? This wasn't something he was doing out on the field. This was his opinion, and actually the opinion of of all genuine Christians. Anybody who actually says they believe the Bible believe the same things as Israel Folau. So do most of the sports players. A lot of them are Tongan. Most Tongans are Christians of one form or another. It's quite likely that most of them actually believe this. I saw just today one player, I'm not sure which team or which country, stood up and said, hey, actually, I agree with Folau's statement. And about, you know, 2 hours later, he had to issue an apology because he wanted to keep his job.
These people, I mean, they're obviously amateurs and they've never dealt with controversy before, these sorts of people. They should know, never, ever apologize, because you will never be forgiven. These people are not forgivers. They want you to apologize only so that they can nail you down for being guilty. You know, if you refuse to apologize to these people, then I personally will never, you will never see me apologizing for anything that I say ever. Unless it's something that I just said angrily to somebody who I didn't mean to offend. But
It's you should apologize when you're wrong, but you should never ever apologize when you weren't wrong, because then that's it, that's the end. There's blood in the water and whatever it is that you're doing is over.
That's exactly right.
And to come back to Folau's motivations here as well, it was actually an atheist and a homosexual friend of mine who posted this and said, hey, if you genuinely believe in hell and you genuinely believe in sin and you don't tell people, if you don't post this big warning like he posted this, then you're a really horrible person, right? If you saw somebody was about to get hit by a bus and you said, it'll be kind of offensive, like they might be offended if I warn them of the danger that's coming at them.
I don't want to be guilty of ableism.
And so on. You know, like coming up with some lame excuse. Exactly. So he genuinely believes this. He is genuinely giving a warning to people who he believes are in mortal danger.
And he is genuinely worried for these people's eternal existence. I mean, I know plenty of Christians who believe that if you are a homosexual or an adulterer or a murderer, then you are automatically disqualified from salvation because you're considered reprobate. I mean, I personally don't believe that, and I believe that people can repent and stuff. We're getting a little bit off topic,
it's a little bit off topic, but it's also on topic, because what's the big word in here? Repent, right? And that's his. This is not a case of where he's saying, hey, people who are committing these sins, that you're gone. That's it. All right. He's not encouraging people to go and, you know, throw them from buildings or stone anybody or light people on fire or drown them or whatever. He's not calling for people to be damned. He's saying, repent and you won't be damned.
He's not saying, thus saith Israel. He's saying, this is in the Bible. This is what I believe. And you are in grave peril if you don't turn away from these actions.
I think one angle that we should discuss here still before we move on to the next topic is he's obviously got his rights to his opinion, to saying what he is, but he's lost his job for it, he's going to get fired. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? At what point are we talking freedom of speech and freedom of association from his work? They're arguing it was a breach of contract. We'll let the lawyers sort that one out. Based on the wording of that they had from the contract and what he's actually said, I don't see the connection, but you never know how the lawyers and the judges work all of that out. Is it legally okay that he's lost his job? Do you believe there should be protections around people's employment if they do voice their religious opinions? Or are we just running into a situation where the culture has changed and now suddenly you're on the chopping block if you do have these opinions, especially Christian ones that were held for, you know, now have been for well over 1,000 years in the Western world anyway?
Well, this is where I expect Unite Union to come to Israel Folau's defense. Because he is being persecuted. I believe that outside of a legally binding contract, any employer should be able to terminate any employee for whatever reason. Because I'm a free market capitalist and I'm a greedy pig who just doesn't care about workers. That's a joke.
We've got to tell people when we're being sarcastic. I did get a comment from the last podcast. We will let you know when we're being sarcastic.
That was sarcasm. I believe that if it says in his contract, we will be, you know, employing you for the next 2 years unless you embarrass us publicly or something, then if there is something in the contract that they can use as a clause to say, well, you're being terminated because of this, and if it matches up legally and stuff, then I've got no problem with him losing his job, other than, you know, he's losing his job, and that's you know, it's awful. He'll find gainful employment somewhere else. Somebody will hire him. It's not nice, but we have to be consistent, and I never want to be in a situation where I'm an employer and I'm no longer allowed to fire somebody who's brought my company into disrepute. and possibly cost me millions. Is it Qantas?
Qantas, I believe, is a sponsor, but Australian Rugby is the employer. One of the Australian rugby,
but they get a lot of their money from Qantas. Monies.
I believe they get a lot of the money from Qantas, and that is the thing. Is likely this could be a financial decision, and it could be, like I've said, the culture has changed, and for all you know, his opinions might negatively affect their reputation, or if it doesn't negatively affect their reputation, it might negatively affect their incomes, because if Qantas is a big supporter, and Qantas being quite a left wing organization is pulling their support, this could be a move that they are making purely from a looking at the numbers in a monetary sense.
Well, I heard one Australian talking head saying that Qantas had some connection with some Islamic nation that where homosexuals would be put to death.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
That doesn't seem to worry them so
much. No, and we can switch the topic slightly to a related matter, which is the law changes in Brunei recently to bring in Sharia law for the execution of homosexuals. 32 Commonwealth countries, it's illegal. In 74 countries worldwide, it's illegal. That was these numbers I had from last year. So there's a lot of countries where this is illegal. They're not doing trade embargoes against these countries for that, right? So they're essentially placing a personal embargo on him, but they will continue to do business with all of these other countries who clearly go a little bit further than Israel Folau, who says, repent, and you can be saved, to these other nations and say, hey, guess what? We're going to execute you now and you're going to burn forever.
Yeah, I saw a picture of Israel standing next to an obvious cross-dressing man, and he didn't seem to be uncomfortable or have a problem with it. So he's not this hateful, homophobic bigot. Mm-hmm. He's just expressing his religious beliefs.
Based on the wording that I saw in the contract, it did say something. He was not allowed to discriminate. This kind of comment that he made here is not directly discriminatory beyond the normal sense that any comment might be discriminatory.
No, exactly.
He's not excluding people or calling for people to be excluded from anything.
Well, I felt like he was excluding far too many sins from that list. I mean, if you want to start listing off sins, why not list them all?
So I do believe this situation will develop a little bit further, but it's been interesting to see that he really has stuck to his guns, to see that people have rallied around him, and to see this interesting disconnect between this rugby organization that doesn't consider people who are actually criminals to be a risk to them or to be in breach of their contract. You know, they're happy to hire wife beaters and violent thugs who have done prison time for this, that, and the other. So it's just interesting to see the cultural shift and where they think the money is.
Well, I think it's, to wrap it up, to explain why, you know, these 74 countries worldwide that have homosexuality as illegal, there's no big hubbub about that. It's because those countries don't threaten the platform that the left-wing media is based upon. And Israel Folau does, because he's got over 100,000 followers on Twitter or something.
Yep.
You know, he has a strong platform. And he has a voice, and he has the ability to persuade and to change mind, and he is a threat to the Western left-leaning media's platform. So it's always good to drag someone like that through the mud, because, you know, the quicker that you can destroy their character, the safer your platform will remain.
Yeah, and the safer their agenda remains, and this helps to further their agenda. And to finish this, wrap this up with my own comment is, especially the New Zealand media, and because this is an Australian story, but it feels like a New Zealand story because the New Zealand media has a huge hatred for this guy. I mean, mm-hmm. they really, really have it in for him, and they really hate him. And you can see that most of this, perhaps, is a media job. This is the media creating a story, and it's hard to see how much populistic support there is behind what's happening. And it's hard to see these numbers because the media does such a good job of hiding it and keeping their control over the narrative.
I've personally not seen or heard anybody who's been offended or morally outraged about. I've heard all these secular atheists saying, so what, he's got an opinion, you know, let it go.
All right, and we'll move on to our next topic here. Changes in New Zealand in the polls. We have had two polls released since we did our last episode, and I think it would be worth talking about them just a little bit. One by Business NZ and Reed Research, and the other one by One News, Colmar Burton. And they were both done after the Christchurch massacre. The Reed Research one started on the day of the massacre by pure coincidence, but they both paint a very similar picture. So we're seeing National basically seems to be sitting at around 40%, which isn't really a drop from last time. We're seeing Labour increasing their lead up to just under 50% or 48% maybe. New Zealand First is steady on their kind of averaging at around 3% in the last six polls or so. And the Greens bouncing around a little bit, but maybe scraping in at their 5% average. And these polls haven't really given us solid numbers on any of the minor parties, so it's hard to tell. Overall, we see a lead of around 8% for Labour. We see, and we have seen this in the last dozen polls, basically, is Labour and the Greens would govern alone. NZ First has probably gone, and National stays a fairly large opposition. Jacinda obviously got a boost from the way that she handled the aftermath of the Christchurch massacre, at least early on. But people have made comparisons to John Key's handling of the Christchurch earthquakes, and John Key had a bigger boost. The National Party was polling well above 50% for a while, and the Labour Party just hasn't got a boost that big. And so the real question about these polls is, we're seeing what anybody might expect, but the numbers for Labour and for Jacinda aren't as great as you might want to see if you were Labour or Jacinda, or if you were on the left in general. You'd probably be happier with a higher level of popularity, but you would be quite consoled by the fact that Simon Bridges is non-existent and clearly disliked, and there isn't really a clear challenge in the National Party. In the media, lots of rumors about Simon Bridges departing. They want to get rid of Simon Bridges, of course. But is that really a good idea? Is that something National's going to do? Is there a real feel for change there? Because that's the most likely change we're going to see before the next election, is some kind of shakeup in the National Party. That's what I see.
In my opinion, in my well-learned, humble opinion, Simon Bridges was done from the very first day that he became
poison chalice.
He's not awful. He's just no one. He's milquetoast. He's nothing. He's nobody. I mean, it's really made me, I mean, I didn't think I could lose any more respect for somebody who I didn't respect at all. But over the Christchurch hullabaloo, he's just been following along with what Labour's been doing. Just the little toddler in tow. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not said anything. The only controversial things he said is, well, I'm worried about how fast this is all happening. But mm-hmm. he's not really, because he's also saying this is a great opportunity.
Exactly. And I actually wrote this about 48 hours after Simon Bridges became leader of the National Party. He had his first interview. After I listened to his first interview, I wrote down, Simon Bridges will never be Prime Minister.
No.
And I feel like I'm so far completely justified in that statement. And, you know, barring some freak accident, which is always possible, but he won't earn it. And usually taking over from someone who's popular is a bit of a poison chalice, and it's possible that they handed it to him knowing, if he's somehow miraculously good, maybe he'll win. But most likely, he's kind of got to carry, he's sort of got to hold the bag while they decide who's going to replace him.
Yeah, maybe they knew that Ardern was going to be popular because she's young, she's a mum, she's a blah, blah, blah. Maybe they knew, let's just throw in a dud and not waste one of our good guys, because I personally don't see Paula Bennett or Judith Collins.
Well, that's the thing. Neither. I used to think Judith Collins maybe, but after the recent events with legislation, and whenever they're interviewed about firearms or hate speech or whatever you think of, it's all the same, right? They're all reading the same script. The National Party has analysts, they have experts, and they have these people writing the statements and the policies, because that's all that I'm seeing. They have people who are doing some kind of behind the scenes polling and getting a vibe and saying, ooh, we got to follow along with what Labour's doing. We got to do what Jacinda, we got to tell everyone Jacinda's doing great. We can't oppose anything Jacinda's doing because we don't want to be seen to be contentious, and we want to be seen to be working towards unity. And they're not actually calling out the bad things, right? It would be fine to say, oh yeah, we want to work together on stuff, but not like this, yeah. Right? This is not how we do it.
But that'll never happen, because parties like Labour and National, they both do the same thing. They play the long term. They're not worried about getting into Parliament next time around, or even the time after that, because they know that sometime in the next 20 years, they will get it.
Yeah, that's right. They will win. They will win an election eventually. And one-term prime ministers are fairly rare in New Zealand.
Mm.
Obviously, if you have a bad enough prime minister, it could be that. And National's basically thinking, oh yeah, let's give them this. And then we'll go back to the issues that we think are popular, like capital gains tax. Nobody cares about free speech or democracy or firearms. Nobody cares about that. That's all.
No, that's all. The reactionary small parties.
But you know, capital gains tax, that's big. We'll go for the capital gains tax, and that's going to be our focus. And we're just going to talk about capital gains tax forever, because that's how we're going to win the next election, or we're going to win the election in 3 years or 6 years.
It's the only thing that Simon Bridges has the balls to challenge Labour on, because it's not got anything to do with the Christchurch massacre. It's got nothing to do with the big emotional stirring that the media has done.
And it's not netting many wins, right? They're just slowly bleeding support, which is not as bad as Labour did in the past. Very few people are really interested in politics. For a lot of people, it's charisma rather than policy. And so and if you look at the last few elections in New Zealand, you can see that policy doesn't really get you anywhere. Charisma and the idea that you're going to win and looking good is actually incredibly important. There is no better example than Jacinda Ardern, because the Labour Party didn't change any policy.
No.
They just swapped out the leader. They haven't actually changed anything that they were going to do.
No.
And that's been the case.
Yeah.
And yet it has won them. It's taken them from 20% up to nearly 50% now. Mm. Right? No changes in policy, just a change in the way that you are presenting yourself, just changing the face of the party. And that's what John Key did incredibly well. This is why National did incredibly well under John Key. And John Key was far more popular than Jacinda, which sounds weird to say, but John Key was more popular than Jacinda.
Well, that's because he said that he wasn't going to raise GST.
Oh, good one. Again, what's National changed since they got rid of John Key? Nothing. They haven't changed any policy. Oh. Yet they're down 10, you know, they're down nearly 10% in the polls. You got this game where they play backwards and forwards. They swap out the faces, and some people just don't gel with the public. They just don't have the charisma. They come across as flakes, as insincere, as frauds, and that's really Simon Bridges' biggest problem. He doesn't come across as genuine. And you see him flip-flop around on these statements. Whenever something slightly controversial comes up, he's like running around in a circle, and he changes his tune every 5 seconds, trying to find the right set of words that have been pre-approved by to give the right amount of popularity. And people can see through that.
He needs to wait for about a half a dozen analysts to lick their finger and see which way the wind's blowing. This is my interpretation of what the National Party is going to be doing to select their new leader. They'll just pull up their little list of people, and they'll just scroll down and go, no, he's too old, she's too... Oh, maybe Nikki Kaye, she looks young enough to challenge Jacinda. No, not
that's right,
Julie
Nikki Kaye. Nikki Kaye is going to give the Jacinda effect, you know.
No,
right?
Louise Upston looks like somebody's auntie. No. Maybe Alfred Naro, though, he's a bit too old. No. Oh, they'll scroll down, and they'll be looking at people based entirely on what they look like immediately. To be fair, my whole theory goes out the window when you take a look at John Key. I mean, he was not a particularly handsome man, was he?
It's not purely the looks. You got it slightly wrong, but you're on the right track. It's not just about the looks, it's how they come across. You're not looking at a static picture, you're looking at the moving picture.
That's true.
You interact with them, see how they interact with people, see how people react to them.
And Simon Bridges has the charisma of a wet sock.
The charisma of a damp rag, and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk. And then if I'm truly in Nigel Farage fashion, tomorrow morning I'll have to go out in front of the cameras and make an apology for offending the bank clerks everywhere.
Well, what you could do is, as soon as Simon Bridges has done his first speech, you could get up and say, "Who are you?"
Actually, that was my reaction when I heard that Simon Bridges was selected to lead the
National
Party.
Reaction when I heard.
I'm like, who is this guy? Which is why I think we're both correct in thinking that he was handed the poison chalice because they knew that he would fail, mm-hmm. and that's part of the plan.
Yep. Just to touch on why we don't see any obvious results from the minor parties, I think that can easily be explained by the people who vote for these people. They are small, they are in pockets, and so a broad sort of poll is not going to pick them up.
Mm.
You're only going to get accurate results on the election day, because while they have a relatively low supporter base, that supporter base is quite devout. And so they will make it to the polls and they will vote. And half of the Labour voters might vote, half of the National voters might vote, but all of the new Conservative Party and most of the ACT people will vote.
I've been analysing these for a little while, looking at the numbers, looking at the election results, and when I can, looking at the numbers behind the polls. They do struggle a little bit with the smaller parties, because you're dealing with a small sample size of around 1,000 people, and then they have to make guesses and put a bit of math into what they think the support is going to be, and especially when you're dealing with percentages of 1 to 2 to 3%, they really struggle with that.
Yeah,
and they don't care. This is something that I noticed as well. I watched a little clip from the News Hub reporting their poll about a month ago. They said, oh, this is how National's doing, this is how Labour's doing, this is how New Zealand First are doing, this is how the Green Party's doing. Don't worry about the other parties, the little parties, and they move on. So they don't
actually
care.
Please don't vote for them.
If you vote for the minor parties, you won't be my friend.
Exactly, and you know they don't care who it is, right? They don't want you to vote left, right, or center. They don't want you to vote for ACT. They don't want you to vote for TOP or Maori or New Conservative or Outdoors Party or any of these other little parties. They want to keep the focus on the big players because that's where they get their two-horse race, but it's actually, you know, two horses pulling the same cart.
That's who have corporate interests at the forefront. I have this argument with a guy at work all the time. He's constantly telling me how Nationals just corporate whores, etc. I'm telling him like Labour's corporate whores as well. He's like, yeah, but National. It's like, all right, okay. So you've just bought into the the typical, you know, the right wing are all corporate whores and the left wing are all union touting for the workers' rights and all these sorts of things. But I haven't heard Jacinda Ardern or any of them talking about workers' rights. They're not your traditional left wing party. I mean, he's still living in the 80s. I think
the left wing parties used to be about workers. But now
the unions used to be about the workers.
That's right.
They're about cultural Marxism.
And this is where you see a shift, and the shift has not hit New Zealand. And if I were to make a prediction, I'd say it's not actually going to hit New Zealand in a big way very soon. Things in Europe really got really bad before you started getting these populist parties. They called far right parties, but in the sense they're actually the old school Labour approach. So if you saw the Labour Party in like the 70s and the 60s and the 50s, that's basically what these new nationalist, populist, far-right, evil parties are like. Yeah. They're the old-school workers' parties who are you know, going for the interests of the local workers and over that of the interests of foreign entities.
Lower taxation, lower immigration, and more jobs. That's all they want.
Exactly. And of course, they want all of these so-called far-right parties want stronger safety nets as well for local workers and local businesses and so on. And they are protectionist. All of these things that you don't really associate with the modern right wing is what these quote-unquote far-right parties are all about, which is traditional left-wing policies. And so you're seeing this split where it's no longer left versus right in terms of old-school socialism versus normal capitalism, but you're rather seeing a bit of a blend there, and it becomes a shift between nationalism and globalism.
Or authoritarianism and libertarianism.
Exactly. Which is authority, liberty, nationalism.
That's the lens that I see everything through. Is, are you trying to control me? Are you trying to stop me from doing anything that I should be allowed to do? That's basically how I see everything.
But in New Zealand, things haven't really gotten bad yet. We're nicely isolated. We're likely going to see some big shifts in the coming years, and I don't think we'll see the effects of that for another decade or two. And I think some people will be sad to hear me say that, but that really is the way that I see it.
But rest assured, we will see it. We will see it.
Eventually, things get bad enough, and you'll see it. Same thing in Europe, right? You would not have imagined half of any of these parties who are currently winning elections. I mean, they just did not exist 10 years ago. They weren't there, and they had no support, and now they're getting 20%, 30%, and they're forming governments.
Mm-hmm.
Because things have gotten really bad. And that's when, you know, when people get desperate, then they, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Yeah, at the moment, we're still at the level where it can all be brushed away with a simple, you know, media spin. But when you get to the point where, you know, you can't walk into a small township for the amount of newly introduced species,
and when you've got crime rates and women can't go outside and women can't walk around in the dark, and then people get a little bit worried. Yeah. And then when you have high unemployment, like New Zealand still has quite low unemployment, these European countries are dealing with incredibly high unemployment rates
and incredibly high taxation,
and then all that they see is more stuff being given to other people who are being brought in, saying, "Oh no, we're taking care of all these poor people from the third world." And then people start saying, well, what about the poor people living here? Because the number of poor people living here is growing.
And at the moment, we're dishing out, you know, public education and benefits to children with beards. So.
And it just gets bad. And New Zealand is going to be a lot more isolated from that, which is actually a good thing for us, because you don't really want things to get bad, but it might be inevitable.
It could be the toad in the pot sort of thing, where they gradually turn it up and the majority of people sort of just don't notice it until it's too late.
This is probably a good time to switch into our final main topic of today, which is WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, who's been arrested. And we're going to talk about the whole issue around whistleblowing and breaking the laws to show that the government is breaking the laws and so on. So for those people who haven't really been following it, which is perhaps few and far between. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, was expelled from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he'd been holed up for 8 years, I believe. I may be off by 1 or 2 years. And he's been arrested, and he might be charged with all kinds of bizarre things. So he's got a supposed rape accusation against him in Sweden still that's been dropped. And the details around that are a little bit odd if you look at it, which is probably why they were going to drop it, because if you look at the details that are out there, it does not look like a prosecutable offense. Like, there's no evidence, there's no nothing.
No, but they don't need a prosecutable offense. They need to bring him out to be able to say they need to bring him out and say, oh no, our mistake, it wasn't actually. But while we've got
okay, that's what it's going to be. And of course, you've got the other pull on, you know, the United States supposedly going to extradite him for some kind of maybe hacking thing that he did maybe 12 years ago. And the whole thing is they've got nothing. But this is what I find the most bizarre thing about Julian Assange, and we'll get around to the whole general WikiLeaks ethos later, is he's been holed up there for 8 years. A lot of these charges that he's facing have prison time of less than 8 years on them. He spent a lot of time imprisoning himself, and he's facing potentially more prison time. I don't understand why he did it. And if you do something like this and you're expecting the government to persecute you and throw you in prison, another good example of someone who's just, you know, dealt with it has been Tommy Robinson. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, you throw me in prison, go for it. You throw me in prison. If I survive, I'm going to come back out and take you on, and, you know, I'll just be bigger and more famous. Yep. Right? You can make a martyr out of me. And Julian Assange seems to have imprisoned himself and driven himself insane, as would happen if you were basically in solitary confinement for 8 years. And now he's out and he may face more prison time.
My mom asked me, what did he do? And I couldn't tell her. Like, the news happened to come on and say that he'd been accused of hacking and stealing information, and they were assuring us that it wasn't a freedom of speech issue, because it was actually a theft issue, because he had stolen this information. But what I want to know is it, and I would say no, is it morally wrong to quote-unquote steal information from the government? Because if you steal information from a private company, that's theft. It's clearly theft. But if you steal it from the government, I don't see anything wrong with it. In the instance of, I mean, there was this Red Cross nurse who she'd been kidnapped, and they had kept that quiet. This is in New Zealand. They've kept it quiet up until now. And that was for her own safety, because they didn't want her kidnappers to use her as a bargaining chip. And if someone had stolen information like that and released it to the public and potentially put her in more danger, I would say, yes, that was the wrong thing to do, because it was careless and it put somebody in danger. But all Julian Assange has done is take information that's shown that governments have broken the law. I mean, back in the day, we used to hang governments like that. We used to hang politicians who would do stuff like that. Not us, but, you know, corrupt politicians.
Oh, hold off there. Be careful.
This might get edited out. This might not make it here. But we generally don't tolerate the government lying to us and keeping secrets that, you know, prove that they did bad. And it's kind of obvious why they want to persecute somebody who's taken that information and exposed their wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that, given the circumstances, that it is a freedom of speech issue, because I don't think the government should keep secrets from us unless it can be shown that, in the instance of this nurse, that it needs to remain secret for her own safety.
Some of the stuff that was released by WikiLeaks did potentially put people in danger, especially interpreters and people who had worked with the US government in Iraq, because a lot of the early WikiLeaks stuff had to do with Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think there were some similar issues where there was some sensitive information that they weren't careful enough with when they released it. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, I'd have to say the same thing. Yeah, my biggest criticism of Assange personally there is, you know, if you're going to do the whistleblowing thing, if you're going to take on the government, be prepared to pay for it. You know, like, don't run from it. Face it. Like, if for instance, if the government introduces hate speech in New Zealand, like, and then I risk going to prison, I would say, well, you know, whatever, come and get me, okay? I wouldn't go and run in an embassy and hide somewhere. I think that's something that's important enough to really stand for and say, okay, I'm going to make you come and get me.
Yeah, I can't defend nor comprehend the actions of Assange putting himself in solitary confinement, basically. I can understand it to a degree if you're being persecuted, and you're going to be tortured or put to death or something. Then yeah, I guess you have to seek asylum. But personally, I'm in the same boat as you. If they, for whatever reason, say, you know, the Bible is now hate speech, I'll be the first person out on the street doing ridiculous yelling at cars, street preaching, until they come and arrest me and throw me in prison. Because it's such an important thing to express and use freedom of speech. But when you voluntarily put yourself in isolation or in what appears to be imprisonment, although it's, you know, refuge, you're kind of admitting guilt. And if you're willing to do it for the last 7 years, I mean, is that not sort of an admission of guilt? Like, you have something to hide? Can you not defend yourself? Do you not have any argument to defend yourself other than running and hiding?
Yeah, and that's probably one of the main things that's resulted in a lower level of sympathy for Assange and WikiLeaks than there could have been. I do believe there is a place overall for WikiLeaks, like we've said, and there is it's not only the right thing to do to release government to release information, especially when the government is breaking the law, and that would be the benchmark for me, is if you're uncovering illegal activity by the government or just immoral activity by the government, I believe you're well within your rights. Or further than that, it is your duty to actually expose that and to release that. And my differing point there is you should own up to it as well, unless you could stay anonymous, which in this case is completely impossible. But if you could, you could try and make sure that you're not discovered. But if you are discovered, you should own it.
Yeah, there's no real argument to say, well, he shouldn't have done that because that's against the law.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, really, that's opening a really huge gateway for the government to just be able
and
to say
authoritarianism. And really, the reason the government has all of this information for WikiLeaks to expose just shows the government is too big, it's doing too many things, it's doing all of the stuff that it shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if the government needs to keep all of this stuff secret, and as we have seen in New Zealand recently and all around the Western world, these intelligence agencies are not super effective, or at least we can't see what they prevent, but we can see that enough stuff slips through, and we can see in some of the objective stuff, we mentioned the TSA last week, when they actually test the efficiency and how good these agencies are at protecting people and keeping them safe, they fail in the vast majority of cases that are tested.
Not only that, but they appear to be inefficient and they appear to be untrustworthy. I know people who are dealing with the intelligence service in New Zealand right now, and it does appear to be a bit of a witch hunt, like they're trying to find quote-unquote white nationalists or extremists where there are no extremists.
Yeah, and we had a story in the news over the last week as well that suddenly disappeared. So it came out of nowhere. Some guy in a Trump t-shirt was yelling at people outside the Al Noor Mosque in Christchurch over the last week. And there was a big news story, oh yes, we finally found the white supremacy in New Zealand, we finally got it. And it turned out to be a guy with a last name. I won't bother saying his name, but let's just say his last name was not of European origin. He obviously was not associated with any kind of white supremacist group, and he didn't really have any deeply held views about anything, really. He was just a guy who got drunk and stoned and had mental issues and was running around the city in a Trump t-shirt, and apparently the first time that he found out about it was when he saw his face on the news. That's the best that we've gotten out of this of the hunt for the elusive white supremacists that are infesting New Zealand.
But it shows how out of hand it gets when he says all this what would be considered abusive stuff towards these Muslims, and the police officers who were currently there did not arrest him. They didn't see any threat, they didn't see any reason to arrest him, but they want to make a mountain out of a molehill, and so they find out about it, they have to go and arrest him, and oh, we found him, we got him, you know, he's in a Trump t-shirt, it must have been white supremacy, blah 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 blah. But it comes back as nothing, and still everybody's talking, still they use it as some sort of evidence of white supremacy, white nationalism in New Zealand, how awful the rhetoric is and how blah 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 blah.
Exactly, because everything must advance the narrative. And to bring this back to the intelligence agencies and so on, is again something like this. Is this on anybody's radar? Is this harmful? They're still running around interviewing people, and we know, I won't mention anybody's names in particular. Some people who are getting the second or third visits from the SIS, some people who have been visited by the SIS 5 times. And if you look at the stuff that they're saying, it is in no way could you look at these people and say, oh yeah, they could be a threat?
Yeah.
All right, like if you look at these, if you were to look at these people, they're not a threat. But yet the intelligence agencies have to follow up on complaints or things that they consider to be odd, and they have to pour all of these resources, they have to pour thousands of man hours into this. And it was just revealed today that the reason why 70-odd Anzac parades have been cancelled is because the police are too tired and they need a bit of a break.
Yeah, the Anzacs just aren't important enough.
And so because the police have been running around, guarding everything, being on super high alert, you know, raiding people's houses, questioning hundreds of people, if not thousands of people throughout the country.
Confiscating weapons.
And on and on and on it goes. All of these people, clearly harmless. Okay, any normal person could have a look at them and say, yeah, there's nothing off here. But they have to keep doing it because that's what's in their hair. That's the reason for their existence. And mm-hmm. They've got to keep doing it. And then when it comes to the, as you said, quote unquote, not important enough.
When it comes to actual police work.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's no point me trying to be coy or sarcastic about this, right? They're basically saying Anzac Day is not that important, not compared to all of the other stuff they're doing.
Not compared to the routine traffic stops and the routine, you know, breathalyzers and whatnot, they need to be armed to the hilt.
Exactly right. They're still doing. I pass one almost every day where they're breathalyzing people doing routine stops. They're still doing those, right? They're supposedly stretched thin. They're still doing all of that standard stuff, armed to the hilt. They're engaging in this quite bizarre behavior, and they're tightening up the security when there's no risk. Right? There's no evidence, because this guy didn't even come from New Zealand. There's no evidence that there's any of this happening in New Zealand. Even the threat of a possible copycat or retaliatory attack is quite low. And this soon after these terrorist attacks, like, you never get them close together. Okay, I was actually in Paris, and this is going to feed perfectly into our final topic. I was in Paris after the Bataclan massacre, and I was there 2 or 3 weeks after that. And people said, ooh, are you really sure you want to be going there? Well, you know, this is dangerous, you know, 100 people got killed. And I said, now's the safest time to go, right? There's just been a terrorist attack. It's probably going to be a couple of months before the next one.
They're not due for another one for at least a couple of months.
Now's the safest time to go. And we were there, and it was indeed the safest time. And this is going to bring into my closing topic now. When we were there, we saw the Notre Dame, and that was the news that we got today. Something that we all woke up to in New Zealand here was the Notre Dame burning to the ground. Thankfully, not all of it has burned to the ground. We haven't got very many details yet. The French government says they're acting under the assumption that this was an accident rather than arson. They don't actually know that, of course, because they made that statement while the building was still on fire. But they're giving the impression that they don't have any clear leads on what they think to be suspicious behavior. We will find out in the coming days and weeks.
We may find out in the coming days or weeks.
Or we may never find out.
It's not fair to speculate, though.
No, and we could speculate. And there's lots of coincidences. Obviously, being the first day of the, you know, the holiest week of the year for the Roman Catholic Church, there being dozens of attacks on Roman Catholic churches throughout France in recent weeks and months and years. So there's a lot of strange coincidences. I still got to finish telling my story. I was in the Notre Dame, and what an absolutely beautiful, amazing building it was. And I saw there the organ, and at the time I didn't know how amazing this organ was. I saw a video today of the organ and somebody playing on the organ, and I thought, absolutely amazing instrument. One of the most, if not the most amazing organ in the world. And last week we closed the episode out with an organ piece, and I just played it at the end. It was Bach's Art of the Fugue. It was played by a local Auckland organist, Indra Hughes, and a lot of people told me they enjoy that piece, and it won't always be an organ piece, but I'd like to wrap every episode up with some kind of classical piece, some kind of artwork, and in this case we're going to wrap up with at least the opening bars of Johann Sebastian Bach again, the Toccata and Fugue, played by Olivier Latre. He was the last one to record an album on that organ. Yeah, enjoy a few seconds of this, and I can't play too much of it for copyright reasons, but I'll risk just the opening 30 seconds or so. Before we go, don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel, add the website to your RSS reader, add the podcast to your podcast reader. If you go through to the website, you'll find the details for that now. And if you're on any of the social medias, please do follow us. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Give us feedback. We will take your feedback into account. We will improve this podcast over time. Thank you very much, Jesse, for joining me again.
No worries.
See you all next time.